This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
So lots of movies to discuss with the good doctor at the Shetland Film Festival. Richard, on this email from Salisbury, I await today's instalment of The Good Doctor with great anticipation. We have the perfect Commodian Storm, a Guy Ritchie film, and something
and
with... And Keira Knightley on the Keira same Knightley. Friday. The rant could well be off the scale. I'd suggest you issue a warning that it could seriously damage sound equipment used to listen to it. Also, I hope that you have an ambulance standing by for the good doctor in the Shetlands, as this much in one go could cause so much excitement that he does himself an injury. Well, you just never know what's going to happen. All that to come because we are doing Bangkok Dangerous, Rock and Roller and The Duchess, the box office top 10 first of all. Before we go any further, Wall-E hanging on in there at 10.
Well, let's try and belt through this because we've got to get other stuff done. So, yes, it's great, but do go and see Silent Running or get it out on DVD because that is the film that it's based on.
Wild Child is at 9.
Not even St. Trinian's.
You Don't Mess with the Zohan at 8.
Funnier Than Munich.
Babylon AD at 7.
Now, I was off last week. This is a Vin Diesel action movie, and I haven't seen it. In catching up in movies that I haven't seen, I went to see The Love Guru, which was rubbish, and now isn't even in the top 10. So what good was that?
Well, you could have gone and see Babylon AD instead.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I figured I got to catch up with that Mike Myers movie. You know, they all take so much money. Nope, not even in the top 10.
Get Smart at 6.
Well, Inspector Gadget for teenagers. Anne Hathaway broadening her repertoire slightly, but I did laugh a few times.
Get Smart at 6.
Yeah, we just did that.
Get Smart is at number 6.
Yeah, and I just said it's not as good. Yeah,
at 6, Get Smart.
What am I missing?
Oh, it's just a satellite delay, Mark. Don't worry about it. The Dark Knight's at number 5.
Okay, don't take under 12s to see Batman because it's made for over 12s. And the BBFC have told you that you need to be a 12 certificate. You need to be 12 to go and see it. And if you take your under 12s to see it, then, it's your own fault if they get upset.
Hellboy 2, The Golden Army at 4. Paul in Nottingham says, Dear Tongue and Groove, while watching Hellboy 2, which I thought was fantastically derivative and largely a waste of time, I had an epiphany. Horror is the only true cinema, says Paul. As a man scared of the dark, this is something of a problem. I know... I'm inevitably going to have to tackle The Exorcist and The Orphanage sooner or later. I'm no longer satisfied by diverting cinema and need to endure what I now know is going to become the digital version of crack cocaine, horror movies. So there you are.
Well, there's an interesting thing.
Thought you might like that.
William Friedkin, who I love the chance to get in at the earliest possible opportunity, once said that there's only really three reasons for making movies: to scare people, to make them laugh, or to turn them on. And that means there's only sort of three genres of movies. I actually think, as far as horror movies is concerned, they are the sump from which all great cinema comes. And it's not surprising that so many people who cut their teeth in horror movies then go on to do such great work elsewhere. I think Hellboy 2 is even better than Hellboy.
The Strangers is at number 3.
Again, I was away last week. Liv Tyler thriller. Who sat in for me last week? Was it Andrew?
It was Andrew Collins, yeah.
And what did he say about The Stranger?
Well, let me bring you this from this is Toby in Manchester, who says, Dear Jack and Vera, saw Strangers the other day, found the first half hour interesting, but found the majority of the film, when the masked beings were running about scaring the couple, tedious. However, at the end, when they pulled their masks off in the daylight, I found the final scenes realistically gripping. Can I ask Mark, why is it that masked villains in films always seem to have respiratory problems?
It's because otherwise there's nothing for the actors to do whatsoever. It's like that, the famous story about Dave Prowse being Darth Vader. Because, as you know, if you've seen Star Wars, Darth Vader is actually acted by Dave Prowse, and Dave Prowse did the breathing and he did the voice of Darth Vader. And then in the very last moment, George Lucas said, well, we don't want the voice of Darth Vader, we actually want the voice of James Earl Jones. And Dave Prowse could never understand why it was that they didn't use his voice when they used his body. And the reason is because he's Dave Prowse. They didn't want somebody going on saying, use the Force, Luke, ah!
I should have said respiratory problems, but respiratory just seemed appropriate at the moment.
No, respiratory is correct.
Well, that'll do. Mamma Mia's at 2.
So bad, it's brilliant. And I've now seen it twice, and the second time round, it was even funnier. And the marvellous thing was, second time round, at the moment in which Pierce Brosnan started singing, literally, the whole cinema started bursting out laughing, and it was fantastic. It was a great communal experience.
And the UK's number one is Step Brothers.
And again, I was away last week. Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly comedy from the director of Anchorman. I don't like Will Ferrell. I quite like John C. Reilly, and I don't like Anchorman. So there's 2/3 of the possibility it's not going to be very good, but I have to see it this weekend.
So let's tackle something new. What do you fancy?
Okay. Rock and Roller. New movie by Guy Ritchie, who you had on the programme just the other day, right?
Yes.
You had Mark Strong on the programme just the other day.
Yeah, we had them as a double bill.
Okay, so here's the deal. On the poster, it says there's a quote from some magazine. I don't know which magazine it is. And it says, you know, basically a return to guns and geezers form for Guy Ritchie. And it says in big letters, from the director of Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. Of course, what it doesn't say is from the director of Swept Away and Revolver. Because basically what happened to Guy Ritchie's career was this. He made Lock, Stock, which is a load of, you know, flash. And everyone went, oh, wow, great new visual style, brilliant. And then he made Snatch. And everyone went, yeah, that kind of the same. There's Brad Pitt in it, but sort of the same movie. Then he made Swept Away, which, quite apart from being, you know, just a misogynist horror of a film, was an absolutely disastrous movie from his career's point of view. Won a record number of Razzies, was nominated for something like 10 Razzies, including, you know, that stuff, worst film, worst director, worst actress for Madonna, worst screen, all those sort of things. Then went away and made Revolver, which, when he came on the Mayo show, I think it must have been this time last year or maybe 2 years ago, and he did that absolutely brilliant interview when he explained that he wasn't going to make guns and gangsters movies anymore, that what he was really interested in was concepts and metaphors, and that was what he was going to do. And he made Revolver, which is, I think by anyone's reckoning, one of the worst films of the century. I mean, I'd be really surprised if between now and the end of this century we get many films that are worse than Revolver. I mean, it was one of those things when critics were literally watching it with their head between their knees thinking, this is it, this is the end of a you can't go anywhere beyond this. It's the ne plus ultra of let's make a really, really bad film.
It's so, the what is it again?
Ne plus ultra.
Right, and in translation?
It means you can't go any further than this, basically.
Thank
it's the
you.
It's you know, it's the lowest possible point. In the same way that Maniac was the ne plus ultra of the mindless gore, although actually it wasn't, people said it was, but they were wrong about it. So anyway, so what Guy Ritchie does is, having told you, because it's interesting, in your interview with him just the other day, you said to him, oh, well, you said you don't want to make any more guns and geezers movies. He said, did I say that? I don't remember saying that. Well, I don't even think I did say that. Well, yes, he did. He said it in the interview with you. He said he was interested in making movies about concepts. So what he's done is he's gone back and made Rock and Roller, which is basically the Guns and Geezers movie. A bunch of people, one of them's called Mumbles and one of them's called Wantu, and they all talk like this, and they go,
your Jason Statham voice.
No, Jason Statham's like this.
Oh, right.
Jason Statham's like that. That's different. Danny Dyer's like that. That's Danny Dyer. That's Danny Dyer. And then people in Guy Ritchie movies are like this. They go, God, blimey, Geezer. All right. So what we have is Guy going back, doing the thing that he said he wasn't interested in doing anymore, because he thinks, okay, it's bankable. Nothing else works. It's bankable. And even before we get to the review, let me say this. In America, there's an executive at Warner Brothers whose only comment on the film was that it was funny in spots and very English. And when you're at the point when the studio that backed the movie think that's the best they can say about it, believe me, you're in trouble.
Dear Sigmund and Joseph, we've been looking for something to do this evening and been won over by the good doctor's horrendous summary of Revolver. And we'll head out to rent it immediately. Sounds peculiarly awful. Paul in Barnet, is Rock and Roller as good as Rancid Aluminium? Okay, look, here the deal is, you must answer that question in this stuff that's coming up.
Okay, I will do, yeah. Shall we start the review off by having a clip? Because I think you have to hear a little bit of Rock and Roller just to get the general gist.
Okay,
can I say one of the things that's wrong with the DVD of Revolver is that it doesn't have on it the interview which you did with Guy Ritchie, which I think ought to have been on that DVD, because that was one of the best interviews I have never laughed so much in all my life as to hear Guy Ritchie explaining the philosophical numerical background of Revolver on Mayo. It was a work of genius. Anyway, here's a clip from Rock and Roller.
People ask a question. What's a rock and roller? And I'll tell them. It's not about drums, drugs, and hospital drips. Oh, no. There's more there than that, my friend. We all like a bit of a good life. Some the money, some the drugs, others the sex game, the glamour, or the fame. But a rock and roller, oh, he's different. Why? Because a real rock and roller wants a lot.
That was Mark Strong, and they're the opening moments.
Yeah, Mark Strong is actually one of the best things in the film. And frankly, after that opening monologue, I'm just lost completely. Again, when you interviewed him, let me give you a couple of choice things from what Guy said to you. A rock and roller is someone with a strong desire for life, but without filters for good and bad. It's an allegory. It's an allegory for celebrities crashing. It's an extreme version of a cliche, the filmic version, the hyper-real version. And then talking about the painting that features in the film, he said, art is a reflection, a metaphor, and my favourite Guy Ritchie description of what's going on in Rock and Roller, to a degree, it's about the human struggle. No, it's not. It's about the struggle to get your career back on track after you have sunk it so deep that not even submarines could find the wreckage of the last movie you made. It's basically, I mean, as far as the plot's concerned, he said, well, the thing is, I think that London's changed an awful lot in the last 10 years and no one's noticed and I've made a movie. Well, actually, a lot of people have noticed. In fact, if you've read any film review for the last 10 years, you will notice that every film reviewer keeps pointing out that every film that's shot in London is about the fact that London has changed. Every film reviewer ends up saying, look, there's another shot of the Gherkin. Haven't we got past the point of realising that the architecture of London has changed? Point one. Point two, Russian gangsters. Russian gangsters in London? That's a very novel and interesting idea. It's a shame that I saw it done before in Eastern Promises, which by no means was the first film about Russian gangsters in London. And incidentally, was yet another film about the fact that London has changed. Actually, what Guy Ritchie has done is he's gone back to Long Good Friday, right? Long Good Friday, which is an absolutely brilliant gangster movie, incredibly intelligent, fantastic performance. And he's redone the Long Good Friday as effectively performed by Chaz and Dave. I mean, watching Rock and Roller, it's like somebody's doing some incredible Little Britain-style pastiche of the Long Good Friday. I mean, characters talking like this, you keep expecting them to go, cake, cake, oh, cake, I like cake, get the shooters and do it. And in the middle of it all, this incredible question, what is it that Tom Wilkinson is doing in that movie other than being instructed to do an impression of Bob Hoskins in the Long Good Friday? So it's the most unbelievable conceit, which is somehow people won't remember what a great, independently spirited, really intelligent, smart, ahead of the curve movie The Long Good Friday was. Let's remake that movie years after the fact, after all this stuff has happened, after all this change has happened. Let's take all the brains out of it, let's take all the wit out of it, let's take all the great performances out of it, and let's just make another movie in which a posh bloke basically leers over the spectre of geezers and gangsters. And, you know, that opening thing about, oh, this is what a rock and roll is. I'm sorry, even the New Musical Express wouldn't sink that low. Not even the dumbest of music papers would write something that infantile, that crass, that absolutely, I'm sorry, I'm a sixth former and I know what a rock and roller is. And worse still, at the end of the movie, when you get to this 2 hours of ludicrous drivel about, you know, in which we're meant to feel sorry for, or meant to feel any form of sympathy or engagement with these characters who are so two-dimensional, so completely, you know, this is the best that Guy Ritchie can do. It's, you know, this is what gangsters talk like. I know, because, you know, I know all about gangsters. No, you don't. Then in the middle of it, there's a character who, there's an issue about character sexuality, about whether or not he's gay, because clearly Guy, in the middle of his career going down the toilet, saw Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and went, oh no, there's a character in that called Gay Paris. I better have a bit of that. So I got a bit of Eastern Promises, I got a bit of Long Good Friday, I got a bit of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I'll put all those together, bit of Lockstock, bit of Snatch. Nobody will notice that I torched my career with those two other movies, and everyone will forgive me for it. And the worst thing about it is that critics have been so stunned by how bad Revolver was that some critics have actually ended up looking at Rock and Roller and going, well, you know what? It's not that bad. I mean,
that's what I thought.
But Simon, it's you have to take a firm line here, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Go on, take a firm line. But I did quite enjoy it.
No, you didn't.
Oh, no, sorry, I realise I'm wrong.
No, you didn't quite enjoy it. What you did was you were quite relieved. And I know this, Simon, because, you know, you're a smart guy. And also you interviewed him about Revolver, right? So you know how low the bar was. Okay?
Yeah.
So when you watch a film that looks like it's even vaguely coherently put together, everyone's astonished. But the most amazing thing about Rock and Roller is that it's not even coherently put together. It's, you know, he does this thing about shuffling time frames, like, oh, wow, I've just invented shuffling time frames. Have you not been watching a movie for the last 10 years? Have you not noticed that every filmmaker is making movies with shuffled time frames? It's not clever. And I'm just, you know, I'm just getting depressed by, I mean, I hate geezer movies. I just hate them. I hate the idea that there's something interesting about these geezer caricatures that don't exist in the real world outside of Guy Ritchie movies.
Soundtrack's quite good.
No, it's not.
It is.
It's not. It's, no, it's not.
It's got the Clash and Lou Reed on it.
Yeah, but, you know, any movie could put the Clash and Lou Reed in their soundtrack.
Well, that's the soundtrack, if you buy the soundtrack.
No, it's not,
good.
Because it's only interesting if it's used intelligently.
Well, a soundtrack album's a soundtrack album. It's got another.
No, that's absolutely where you're wrong. A soundtrack album is not...
I can't be wrong twice in a minute.
No, you can. A good soundtrack is a movie that uses its music intelligently. Now, look, there are a million reasons for me. I know everyone's just going to say, oh, well, you hate this because you hate Guy Ritchie movies. And it's true, I do hate Guy Ritchie movies. But I went into Rock and Roller thinking, OK, this is going to be the moment when he gets it right. There's a number of things about them. You know that band, The Subways, right? They're involved in it. And I like them very much. And I just... I sat there thinking, I can't believe how crass and retrograde this is. It's a movie that even the director doesn't believe in. And people are only being soft on it because of how low the bar went as a result of Revolver. I mean, at least in the case of Revolver, it was a movie that was so staggeringly stupid that it was memorable. You could put a flag in it and go, there we go. This is an outpost of something in Plan 9 from Outer Space terms. In the case of Rock and Roller, the Rancid Aluminium comparison, incidentally, is perfect. You know what? No, it's not as good as Rancid Aluminium.
There you go. Well, you know, and enough said. But here's an interesting point from Mark on this. If I like Lock, Stock and Snatch, will I like Rock and Roller? And my hunch is that he will. If you know that we're back into familiar territory, and if you know that it's the remake of The Long Good Friday with all that stuff taken on board, chances are Mark and his mates may well enjoy this.
Well, in that case,
well, they might be wrong.
No, what they need to do is
enjoy it. If they like Lock, Stock and they like...
Hang on. Enjoying Lock, Stock when it came out is forgivable. Because actually, it's interesting. When I first saw Lock, Stock, I didn't like it at all. Then I saw it again a second time after the American release, in which the Americans had basically branded it as a comedy. And watching it again as a comedy, I thought, oh, well, you know, it's okay. There is something in there after all. And then I saw Snatch and thought, well, no, that's kind of the same movie, isn't it? But all these years later, when what you should have seen is some kind of progress, no, it's not right to enjoy it. I mean, you know, if you enjoy Lock, Stock, watch Lock, Stock again.
You don't need,
and here's the other thing. Guy Ritchie has already said at the end of the movie, he says, all these characters will be back in the real Rock and Roller. And he said in an interview that if Rock and Roller takes money, then he'll make a sequel after he's messed up Sherlock Holmes for all time. Well, that means if you pay to see Rock and Roller, you are paying for him to make the real Rock and Roller.
Diana in Derby, dear Derby and Joan, I've got a pulled muscle in my neck. Could you stop making me laugh?
But the worst thing about it is it's not even funny. I mean, I know.
Can I just read a few comments? I quite like this from Dave in Aberdeen. I still haven't figured which way this review of Rock and Roller is going to go. And I must say, you kept us hanging on there right to the end as to which way you were going to lean. This is what we want, says Andy. Fair to summarise that Mark didn't rate it. Martin in Worksop. I don't think he likes it. Pete in Chesterley Street. So I think you're done on this, are you?
But I just want to say...
No, I think you're done on this, aren't you?
The last thing I want to say... Very last thing. I did go into it with an open mind. I went into it thinking, OK, this is the one that's going to change. And just before I went in, I said to somebody whose judgment I trust very much, I said... Is it okay? They said, no, I've seen it. Actually, it's pretty good. And I thought, oh, well. And then 5 minutes in, it was all over. It was all over. And it literally, all I needed was that, you know, what's a real rock and roller? He's the one who wants it all. God blimey, I'm married to Madonna. Go away, you horrible man.
Hello, Placid and Angry, says Simon. What film then does have the best soundtrack but is a terrible film? Which is an interesting idea because I was suggesting Rock and Roller might have an entertaining CD attached to it, even if the film is no good. Because there must be such a thing as a very good soundtrack to a poor movie.
Well, my only disagreement with this is that I think that what defines a great soundtrack is music well chosen, which does something interesting with the film. And I don't think it's just like a jukebox collection of songs. I mean, anyone can put a jukebox collection of songs together that actually have no relationship to the film whatsoever. There must be endless examples of that, but you forget the film. The really smart thing, and you look, for example, back at, I know I've been, you know, I've really gone off Quentin Tarantino, but you look at the stuff that Quentin Tarantino did early on when he was using... the Super 70 sounds for Reservoir Dogs, and suddenly took a song like Stuck in the Middle with You and turned it into something else as a result of its use in that film. That's a smart soundtrack. I actually don't like Stuck in the Middle with You. At least I didn't until I saw it in Reservoir Dogs, and then it became a different beast.
Can you name both members of Steeler's Wheel?
Only because I know it from the film. It's Joe Egan and Jerry Rafferty.
Very good. 5 points. This from Paul in Farnham. Just been to see Rock and Roll. A great soundtrack. Enjoyed the film. Guns and Geezers. That's what Guy does. Empire gave Rock and Roller 4 stars. How can well-paid critics be so far apart? Well, because the others are wrong.
Yes.
That's the way it goes. We should say, by the way, hello to Dave Morrissey.
Yes. We should also say hello to Jason Isaacs.
Stephen Fry.
all the members of Fairport Convention.
Focus and Pentangle. And this was new from last week. I'm not sure if you're going to agree with this, but we also accepted all members of the Electric Light Orchestra.
Yes.
And this is because Andrew Collins was a member of the fan club. And Mike the accountant says, now that you've added the members of ELO to your weekly greetings list, I can advise that the two members of the classic lineup that Andrew could not remember last week were the cellists, Hugh McDowell and Melvin Gale. So we had them.
Excellent. And can I also say hello to Merrin Smith?
I don't know. We haven't had a meeting about that. Who's Merrin Smith?
Okay. From the Scilly Isles. And anyone whose first name is Merrin is fine in my book for Exorcist-related reasons.
Fine. But they don't get in on a weekly basis, I'm afraid.
Okay.
And Kenneth Branagh. Hello to Kenneth Branagh. So we need to do the Duchess, I'd have thought.
Yeah, so 18th century story, true story apparently, of Lady, pronounced Georgiana, although the inclination to say Georgiana, Georgiana Spencer, which is made clearly contemporary by the fact that there are obvious parallels with this movie and the life of Princess Diana. In fact, the tagline of the movie is "There were three people in her marriage," which is kind of like saying, okay, guys, here we are, this is the thing that we're referring to. So Keira Knightley plays this posh young woman who's married off to a duke who basically needs an heir. The only reason he wants to marry her is because he needs an heir. She has dreams of a fairy tale. It turns into a nightmare. Here's a clip of Keira and Rafe, Don't Call Me Ralph, Fiennes.
For the life of me, I could never understand why women's clothes must be so damn complicated.
It's just our way of expressing ourselves, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Whatever do you mean?
Well, that you have so many ways of expressing yourselves, whereas we must make do with our hats and our dresses.
Would you go to the bed?
What I particularly enjoy, which that clip highlights, is the extent to which Ralph Fiennes gets assorted meanings out of going an awful lot throughout the film.
He's absolutely in his element here. Look, here's the thing with this film. It's directed by Saul Dibb, whose previous film was Bullet Boy, and it couldn't be sort of further away from that, because it's obviously that was sort of urban and gritty, and this is completely the opposite. This is going into the heritage Laura Ashley stakes. And I have to say that the prospect of Keira Knightley in a heritage-style Laura Ashley kind of movie, which has got overtones of Princess Diana, absolutely makes my blood run cold. But, and it's a very big but, despite the way that the film looks, despite the sort of lavish visual look, it is actually a very, very dark movie. I mean, the subject matter, to some extent, is very similar to the subject matter of films like Marie Antoinette or The Other Boleyn Girl, which have used sort of, a famous young star to do a story about somebody trapped in a very, very public prison. The difference is this is much more effective than either of those two films. And it's much more effective for a number of reasons. I mean, you do actually get a sense of this character being trapped in this hideous situation of not only a loveless marriage, but trapped completely in the public glare. When, as the as the movie goes on, and you've seen it, so you know this as well, as the movie goes on, she becomes a great public figure and the public love her, but there's an absolute vacuum in her personal life in the marriage. When she then becomes a fashion icon, she becomes the people's princess, and at one point when the Duke starts, he actually uses the word love, and you almost expect him to say whatever love means. So in many ways it's kind of a companion piece to the Queen, although in my opinion, it's a much better movie than The Queen, because unlike The Queen, it's cinematic. It's got a very, very good score by Rachel Portman. It's shot with a sense of cinema, and it's a proper film. And you have, on the one hand, Ralph Fiennes doing this very... I mean, Ralph Fiennes is an interesting guy, because he's got a very cruel face. That's why he was able to do Heathcliff. That's why he was able to do, the Nazi commandant in something like Schindler's List. I don't mean it as a criticism of him, but he has a naturally cruel face, and he plays it, this role, really, really well. The thing is, he's playing against Keira Knightley. Now, I know in the past that I have been unimpressed by Keira Knightley. The last film that she was in, I said, well, I think she's, she's improving, she's moving onwards, and I think the IKEA joke, despite the fact that some BBC reporter did actually begin a report on this movie by accidentally referring to her as IKEA Knightley, I said,
you had no idea how scared I was during the interview that it would just slip out by mistake.
I know, but
it didn't.
For the good of the record, I think Keira Knightley is actually very good in this film. I think that she takes a difficult role, and I think she handles it really well. And here's what she does that's clever. The role basically needs the character to be naive at the beginning and to be somebody who's wide-eyed and somebody who really has no idea about the situation that they're getting into. And then as the walls close around her, to develop some air of political, well, not deviousness, but you know, an understanding of the political situation, playing the public off and, you know, somehow attempting to work things out within this public political. And it's a complicated thing to do, because actually the easy thing to do would simply be to play it as a pastiche of Princess Diana. What she does is much more than that. And for the first time in watching a Keira Knightley film, I actually got the sense that she wasn't performing, or I got a sense that she was being the character that she was meant to be. I thought it was well written. I thought it was well shot. I thought the subject matter, which I have to say from the outside, I didn't think I was going to be interested in, was moving. I was, at certain moments, genuinely emotionally gripped by it. And I thought that she did exactly what the character needed, despite the fact that the filmmaker spent rather too much time doing something which is very unforgiving, which is literally sticking the camera straight in her face and getting her to look simply at the screen. It's a very difficult thing. If you look at the poster for The Duchess, it is just that poster of Keira Knightley's face, which is exactly the sort of thing which you don't want to be playing on. I think the other thing is, you look at how young she is. She's in her sort of 20s. And I said the last time I reviewed one of her films, I said, it's possible that she's going to blossom into a much, much better actress. And you forget just how young she is. I forget just how young she is. If this was the first time I'd seen her, and she is still in her early 20s, if this was the first time I'd seen her, I'd say, you know what? That's a very impressive performance with a lot of promise. The problem is there's a whole back catalogue before, which I think has not been great by any means. But as a foot on the line of being a proper, really accomplished actress, and I think it says a lot about her director that he managed to get this performance out of her, she does really well. The film really surprised me. And in a world in which we have Guy Ritchie making those movies, you know, I would much rather that we do this kind of stuff, because this is being done better. It's a better film than The Queen, because it's more like a film and the subject matter is interesting. And her performance, and I make no bones about this, is not just okay, it's actually good.
Nelson on this says, whenever a controversial 12A comes along like Dark Knight, Dr. K goes into a rant about how parents should be strung up and sent to re-education camp if they allow their under 12s to see it. I see The Duchess is also a 12A. Does Dr. K have some antipathy towards parents of 10-year-olds who would take their children to see it? And if not, why not? I have to say, it is quite a lusty film in places. Many people find the 12A certificate very confusing because it is applied to a huge variety of films, some unsuitable for most 14-year-olds and others quite suitable for anyone under 8. Don't blame the parents if they don't know quite what to think.
No, do blame the parents. You go to the website. Yeah, fine. You go to the BBFC website and you look at the parental advice. It says at the beginning of all the 12A certificate films, it's your duty to find out why this is a 12 and you make the decision. www.bbfc.co.uk. You click on the title of the movie and it gives you a description of all the reasons why it's 12, and then you make your mind up. It's the parents' or the guardian's responsibility. If you have access to the internet, there is no excuse for not knowing.
Keith in Sunderland, Mark said about Neil Sean's review of Run Fat Boy Run, how can you say it's the best film of the year when it's only August? Therefore,
how can I say worst film of the century? Because I guarantee
can
you...
Can I finish my little email? Even though you're right in your prediction, how can he say the new Guy Ritchie film is the worst film of the century when it's only 2008?
Because it's that bad, okay? And let me just... Run Fat Boy Run was never that good in anyone's mind. But Rock and Roller is that bad.
Loads of suggestions from bad movies with good soundtracks. But with barely 45 seconds to go, give me a quick Bangkok Dangerous, as someone might
Bangkok
say
Dangerous,
on a Friday night.
I'll do both these. Bangkok Dangerous is a remake of the Pang Brothers movie Bangkok Dangerous, which they have remade themselves. It's yet another Nicolas Cage movie, which is depressingly not as good as Nick Cage movies ought to be. I mean, it's nicely shot and it's stylishly put together and it's flashy, and Guy Ritchie would give his right arm to be able to direct as well as that, but it's still a disappointment. And then we have Disaster Movie, which is yet another in, you know, this great big line of movie pastiches, which aren't movie pastiches at all. Pastiches films that aren't disaster movies, doesn't pastiche them, no laughs whatsoever, everybody involved thoroughly ashamed. Don't go and see it. You'll just make him make another one.
Movie of the week?
Well, The Duchess, you know. The Duchess.
And the best movie of the Shetland Islands Film Festival?
Well, The Vanishing, the original, Spurlos.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.